This is the Medicast, June 9th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to episode 121. I am Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you are a brand new listener, welcome to the MedicCast. Make sure you head over to MedicCast.com and check out all of the other shows in the MedicCast network, as well as links to the MedicCast blog, where you'll find show notes for each episode, links to everything that I talk about, a great way for you to follow up on the information that you receive here on the MedicCast. And I urge you to head over and check out the other episodes, past episodes of this show and the other programs on the network. Great ways for all of you to keep your information in the medical fields up to date. Of course, for all of you long-term listeners, I want to thank you again for all of your support, your emails, your comments and suggestions, all greatly appreciated, and please keep them coming. It's what makes this MedicCast community such a great part of the EMS world. There are a couple of different ways you can become a more active member in the MedicCast community. You can always participate in the forums. Go to forums.medicast.com. That will take you over to the MedicCast forums pages, and it's free to sign up and register over there. And then go ahead and contribute either questions or comments, suggestions, read other people's information and posts, and contribute back in a constructive way. It's a great way for all of us to share our various experiences in the field, because let's face it, there is no way for all of us to experience everything that we need to experience in the medical field, in the EMS world. So it's a great opportunity for us to learn from each other's experiences, both positive and negative experiences. And you can do that together over at the MedicCast forums. You can also contribute by sending in your emails, like I said. And I got a great email from listener Lee, who wanted to ask if I could share some link information with his site. He wanted to put some badges for the MedicCast up on his website. And you can find his website at emsprime.com. So head over and check out Lee's site. It's a pretty cool site with some good information. And I was more than happy to send him some link information on how he could get more information about the MedicCast and the MedicCast Networks up on his site. And I actually also can include, for people that have websites, the JavaScript for the MedicCast player. So it's a little pop-up player. You've probably seen it at the website. It'll actually pop up in another window so people can continue to surf your site while they listen to the MedicCast. And if you have a website and you would like to have me send you this snippet of code in a text file, I can certainly do that. It would be something that you could use to help spread the word about the MedicCast, as well as providing a text link to the show. Anyone that wants to provide a text link, more than happy to do so. And if you have an EMS website, make sure you let me know, like Lee did, so that I can link back to you as well. Speaking of taking an active part in the site, listener Raphael has generously offered to help out in getting some transcripts together for some of the tips and tricks of the weeks and med of the week in past episodes, so I appreciate Raphael doing that. He's also keeping me honest by following up on some things he finds when he finds any things that need correction in the weekly tips and tricks, and he found some things from last week's episode on medications for diabetes patients, and there's some things that we need to just kind of follow up on. First of all, I had mentioned metformin and glucophage. These are actually the same medication. One is the brand name. Glucophage is the brand name. Metformin is the generic name. They're actually the same drug. Also, the medication fenformin is discontinued at this time. It may still be in use in some parts of the world, but it is discontinued and not available in the United States because it caused severe lactic acidosis in patients. So I wanted to just follow up on that. Rafael, thank you very much. And we'll soon be offering for download at I think, a reasonable price, some of those transcripts if you'd like to pick them up. And we will be adding them to the MedicCast Extra site as part of the regular services over there. So look forward to that sometime in the near future. And another email I got, what came in from longtime listener Kelly. Kelly's contributed to the show in a bunch of different ways. So, Kelly, I certainly appreciate all the effort you put into making the MedicCast what it is today. But Kelly wanted to send me an email about an article she found about a boy who died of, quote, secondary drowning. This is something that I hadn't really heard of in so many terms, although when I read the story, it certainly makes sense. This boy apparently had been swimming in the water, had had a good deal of fun, and had really gotten a lot of water down the pipes while he was in the water. He came out, claimed he couldn't breathe, and was tired after getting out of the swimming pool, so he went to take a nap and actually drowned from his fluids from his own fluids while taking that nap. It's called secondary drowning, and it's caused by the fluids getting into the lungs actually causing the blood plasma to seep into the lung cavity, into the alveolar space, causing the lungs to have flash pulmonary edema. And that pulmonary edema ultimately will cause respiratory distress and drowning. Something to be aware of, something that people should keep an eye on. And another indication that we need to really take illnesses and respiratory difficulties seriously when children complain of being overly tired, uncharacteristically tired, especially following situations where they may have incurred some respiratory damage. And in this case, we should be asking questions this time of year. Have you been in the pool recently today? Have you been in the water? Did you swallow a lot of pool water? Did you come up coughing? You know, those are the questions that we should be asking. And Kelly, thanks for that. I will provide a link to that in the show notes so that you guys can follow up on that yourself. And maybe I need to talk a little bit about near drowning in a future episode. I also got a voicemail in this week from listener Jeff, who was talking a little bit about an instance that was reported by one of the listeners a few months ago, I guess back in April, talking about patients who had cardiac arrest but still exhibited signs of respirations. And this was something I had not heard of before, but I did some looking around and found that there were some instances where this could happen. Patients were exhibiting respirations even though they were pulseless and had been pulseless for some time. This actually occurred with somebody Jeff knew, and he reported back in on it.
My name is Jeff. I'm a paramedic up in New Jersey. A little behind in shows, just listening to your show from April 27th, the email that Jose had sent it to you. I actually have a colleague who had a patient recently who was pulseless. However, they had a respiratory rate of 16. It was documented by his partner, who's a dual medic crew, nurse on scene, all documented it. The physician, even at the hospital, documented it after the fact. They had a similar occurrence once the patient arrived at the hospital. I've been trying to do some research on this myself. I'm glad to hear that it's not just, obviously, it's a unique cases, but if I come across anything or if anybody else has, I'd be curious to find out myself.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that comment. And I think it's important for, like I said back in the forums section, it's really important for us to share information with each other. When something odd or unusual happens, we may be the only one that's run into that in a while, and it's important for us to get that information out there and either find out if anyone else has dealt with it or find out and get the information available so that the next person that runs into something odd will have a little bit better handle on how to deal with it or at least know what it is they're looking at. So I appreciate it, Jeff. Thank you very much for taking the time to call into the voicemail line. For the rest of you folks, you can always call into the voicemail line. If you put the phone number in your cell phones, 941-306-3342-941-30-MEDIC. You can call into the voicemail line whenever you're listening to the show and let me know about something that's occurred to you that you'd like to share with the other listeners. A great way to contribute back to the MedicCast community. Time to jump on in and look at this week's news. This week in the news, there's some good stories on EMS providers in the field, and I picked one in particular, looking at a teenager who recently got a job as an EMT after he got out of school and looking for a summer job. And I think it's something we don't often focus on. Yeah, I know we don't make as much per hour as many of us would like to make. I think that EMS providers are very underpaid and underappreciated as far as the medical profession goes. But that said, the EMS career path is pretty recession-proof right now. There are a lot of people out there hiring. So especially for the young providers coming out, there seem to be plenty of jobs available. This is a look and in this article at a teenager who was able to find a job very quickly while other people, his friends and other people his age, were really unable to find as many jobs, and certainly not jobs as exciting. Jobs like fast food jobs, restaurant jobs, clothing stores, or local business jobs. Certainly nothing as exciting as working on the street as an EMT. So there are some pluses to what we do, despite the fact that we don't get paid a lot to do it all the time. At least we do get to get out, see the community, get to get out and not be cooped up in an office or stuck behind a grease fryer all day. I guess that's a good thing. So check out this article and let me know what the marketplace looks like in your community. I'd love to hear back from some of you in different parts of the country on how the EMS jobs and job market are looking for those of you that are graduating soon or have graduated recently. The next article looks at a study that examined the outlook for patients that have heart failure, congestive heart failure patients. And we see many of these patients in the field. We run into them all the time. And it seems that these patients may be a little too optimistic on the outlook for their condition. Congestive heart failure is really only treatable in the symptoms. We can't really fix or replace the cardiac function in such a way that they regain function. We can only slow down the progression towards poorer function. And I think that that's something that many of these people don't understand. They see so many great advances in treatment, and they hear and see so many good things happening with how they feel. And yet, heart failure patients have a 50% chance of dying within 5 years of diagnosis. And these patients seem to be overestimating their life expectancy, and maybe because they have not been given a straight picture on what's going on. It also, I think, from our end, comes down to us being much more proactive in educating our community about how to avoid getting to the point where you have congestive heart failure. Patients that have untreated hypertension, patients that smoke, patients that have risk factors for cardiac disease. All of these things are things that can be prevented and can help people avoid getting to heart failure at all. Also, we need to be very proactive in treating these patients when we do encounter them in the field so that they can have the best possible chance of surviving the hospital stay to go on home again. And so we need to be better patient caregivers in the field, better able to recognize patients that are in heart failure, following our protocols aggressively to treat patients in heart failure and getting them to the correct facility for their heart failure, all can go a long way towards increasing their chances to have the survival that they seem to think and expect to get. So I think that's just something to take away from this particular article. Certainly interesting to look at. And I think it's important for all of us to understand we're going to see more and more heart failure patients as medical science continues to have the ability to help people survive major cardiac events. They will come out the other end with some dead heart muscle and more likely to be heading towards congestive heart failure from that event. You know, I talk all the time about getting out in our communities and being proactive about educating our public about what we do, about how they can avoid injury, how they can avoid increasing their disease problems from whatever their medical history might be. And then I wonder how many of us really go out and do that kind of thing. Well, it always makes me feel good when I see this. EMSresponder.com has an article on an Illinois paramedic who started a program to teach ATV, all-terrain vehicle, safety to kids because he was sick and tired of transporting seriously injured children or arriving on scenes where children had been killed because of a variety of preventable causes associated with all-terrain vehicles. And as we head into the summertime here, we're going to have more and more kids out on their ATVs. Their parents are going to be at work. And if these kids don't take the steps to be safe on their own, nobody else is going to follow up on it for them until it's way too late. So I want to say this is a great program. How did he get this started? Well, really simply, he emailed his local children's hospital and asked them what could be done to get out and educate the community. And he basically started a Survive the Ride coalition, looking at getting kids, teenagers especially, to get out there and wear their helmets when they're riding their ATVs, to ride appropriately sized ATVs, especially for smaller kids. There's no reason for a small kid to be on an adult-sized ATV. To not take passengers with you on the ATV because they are an increased risk for falling off and getting injured. Again, all of these things that are easily preventable, easily talked about, and getting that program out into the community. And this was all started with an email from a paramedic in the field to his local children's hospital, finding out what resources there were available. Have you done anything like that? Is there something in your community that you'd like to educate about? What about pool safety or general water safety? Another problem where kids can get themselves into trouble, and something that is, again, completely preventable. So let's look at ways we can do this. And if you have an initiative like this, let me know about it so I can talk about it here on the show and let other folks know about the good things you're doing in your communities. Finally, I'll wrap up the news this week with a look at some other environmental issues that we might be looking at. How many of you have pulled out your protocol manuals and reviewed your information for heat-related emergencies? Now, that's not going to be the tip and trick of the week this week, although I'll probably jump in on it here in the next couple of weeks. But I did find several articles this week talking about the increased heat expected in parts of the United States, and it's a good time for all of us to review our treatment protocols for heat-related emergencies and look at our notes and information on heat-related emergencies from other sources. Now, I've covered heat-related emergencies here in the past on the MedicCast. Head over to the website. You'll find the search box in the upper right-hand corner, and you can search on heat-related emergencies there on the website. You'll find past episodes and articles posted over there about heat-related emergencies, so you can refresh your knowledge that way. Go back and pull out your textbooks is another good way to check on your heat-related emergencies. And always check on sites like the CDC. CDC.gov is a good place to start. The National Institutes of Health websites have good resources on heat-related emergencies as well. But it's certainly incumbent on all of us to freshen up our knowledge given situations that are changing in our communities, whether that might be more cold in the Southern Hemisphere regions, and listeners in those regions are looking at having increased cold and they're going to be dealing with cold-related emergencies. Or maybe you live in a vacation region and you're going to have more water emergencies. All of these things mean that you should be seasonally checking on what's going on and refreshing your knowledge in a good way to go ahead and be ready for that call that is going to be coming just around the corner. Time to move on into looking at this week's tip and trick of the week. And I'm going to do a double ender here, and there will be no med of the week because I'm going to be talking about a presentation, patient presentation, and pathology, and then we'll be talking about the procedure involved with dealing with that. So I thought I would include that as a two-part tip rather than a tip and a med this week. And the topic we're going to be covering is pneumothorax. Looking at pneumothorax, what is it? What causes it? What is a tension pneumothorax versus a simple pneumothorax? What do we look at in patients and assess in patients in order to determine the severity of this situation, and how do we treat that? Namely, looking at needle decompression treatments of tension pneumothorax in the field. So we'll be covering that here. I have a link in the show notes to a great article over at emsresponder.com, as well as a good article that can be found over at emedicine.com on the topic of tension pneumothorax. So I urge you to head over and check those links out. So let's talk a little bit about the function of the respiratory system and exactly how ventilation takes place in the body, because that is what happens with the pneumothorax. There's a problem in the ventilation, the movement of air effectively into the lungs and then back out of the lungs again. Remember that the chest is a negative pressure cavity, that both the lungs and the heart rely on a negative pressure gradient to help get air into the chest cavity, and also the heart relies on the negative pressure gradient to help venous return occur to the right side of the heart. So when there's a problem with this pressure gradient, when the pressure begins to even out and more closely approach the outside atmospheric pressure, the body is unable to draw in additional air to replace the air that is in the chest cavity freely floating. And the same thing happens on the cardiac side. The return of blood to the heart is impeded somewhat when pressures in the thoracic space increase. So this is what happens in a pneumothorax. Simple pneumothorax is basically a pneumothorax that happens spontaneously because of an underlying disease process, such as a patient with COPD or tuberculosis patients were the most common cause of pneumothorax development. And this is where the lung becomes irritated and rubs a hole in itself. And when the lung tissue gets a hole in it, air escapes from the alveoli into the pleural space and does not go back out through the air passages, but is trapped there. And so each time you take a breath in and then go to exhale, more air is trapped, creating an ever-increasing bubble in the chest cavity. Now, sometimes this does not reach the point where it causes enough tension to cause severe respiratory distress, but it may cause pain. But when this becomes an advancing problem and that bubble gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and starts closing off the space of the lungs, now, you know, you look at the lungs and picture it as a big balloon, and you'll see that that balloon is smaller and smaller each time it goes to inflate because of the bubble pushing and compressing the space available for that balloon to fill up. Now, of course, this is really the case of many millions of small balloons of the alveoli, but as those alveoli are constricted more and more, and fewer of them are able to expand fully, you have decreased lung capacity on that side. According to some studies, somewhere between 8 and 9,000 people in the United States every year develop a primary simple pneumothorax. This is, again, that pneumothorax that develops spontaneously from the rubbing of the lung tissue and irritation. And this can happen to patients that have a history of COPD, patients with tuberculosis, patients with underlying lung disorders. These are the patients that have a medical cause of their pneumothorax, but it is a traumatic injury to the body and needs to be treated just as if it were caused by trauma. Of course, the other side of that is patients who develop a pneumothorax because of a penetrating chest or abdominal trauma situation, and these patients develop a pneumothorax because not air coming in through the air passages into the lungs and then being trapped after escaping the lungs, but air that is drawn in instead of through the airway, through an opening in the skin to the thoracic space. And a picture like if you had two openings to any room, if you have a way to get into that room, air will enter when given the opportunity to do so. So when you expand your chest cage, that thoracic space opens up to decrease the pressure that will cause air to rush in any place that it can. And if there is another opening besides the airway, air will start to go in there as well, depending on the size of the opening. So penetrating chest trauma can cause a pneumothorax as well. And that may be something that we most commonly think about when we think about pneumothorax in the EMS field, is pneumothorax related to a traumatic injury. But we need to remember that there are medical causes as well. It's also important to remember that you can cause a pneumothorax in patients by being too aggressive in your airway management. And by that, I mean you can continue to rapidly ventilate a patient to the point that you actually cause the balloon to fill too much, to overinflate the lungs, and you can blow out lungs in patients that have a disease that may cause them to have weakened lungs. Patients that trap air in their lungs can also have a pneumothorax caused. Patients like asthma patients, when you go to bag these patients, if there's not a good enough way for the air to escape, you are going to cause increased air trapping eventually to the point where a pneumothorax is developed because you're bagging patients trying to get air in when there's not any exhalation occurring. And again, this is something to be aware of, and you'll have to manage appropriately. So what are we looking at when we look at a pneumothorax in the way of presentation? Well, these patients are going to be experiencing some chest pain, some respiratory distress. They may be anxious because people who have trouble breathing, especially in increasing problems breathing, that they're seeing an increase in their distress level, is going to cause them to become increasingly anxious. And they will become fatigued as they try to use accessory muscles and use all of the respiratory resources to try to continue to breathe. These patients are going to have this. Again, good patient history is a great way to track this down. Are they having a respiratory event because of an underlying disease process, or are they having a respiratory event because of a pneumothorax? So a good history is a great way to back up some of your findings. Then you have your physical findings, and there's going to be some things that are going to happen on the same side as the pneumothorax and things that happen on the opposite side. Same side, calling that ipsilateral, I-P-S-I, lateral, ipsilateral, same side. Contralateral, okay, against the other side. So we're looking at contralateral, ipsilateral in our findings here. Again, general respiratory distress found. We're looking for decreased lung sounds or absent lung sounds on one side, on the same side, the ipsilateral side that the patient has the pneumothorax. So when you find absent lung sounds on one side and not the other, the pneumothorax could be the cause. Adventitious lung sounds, and these are crackles and wheezes, would also be more commonly found on the side of the pneumothorax. And this would be in a case where the pneumothorax is still progressing. There's still some retention of air on that side. We're still getting air movement. But as the tissue is compressed and pushed, they're starting to get sounds. We're starting to get gurgling and wheezing as those air passages are squeezed and twisted and pushed in such a way that the air movement is much more audible to our auscultation with our stethoscopes. You can also have other things occurring. You will have hyperresonance of the chest wall with percussion. Now, we're not going to percuss too many patients in the field. It's just way too noisy, and most of us are not very, very good at doing that because it's something that requires practice. But it is something that you may find crop up on a test. So hyperresonance, and just think of it like a drum. Normally that space is filled with lung tissue. Yes, there's air in there, but there's tissue in there around that air. If you take that and just move the tissue out of the way and you have nothing but air, then of course it's going to be hyperresonant on that side compared to the other side. Remember to always compare your auscultations side to side, checking each field on each side to compare where the pneumothorax might be occurring. Is it high? Is it low? Again, these things can all help when you go ahead and get medical control involved in the patient treatment. Patients may also be experiencing cyanosis, although that can be rare. Patients may have some resistance. If you're bagging these patients, you may notice that they are not as compliant as they were before because, of course, you're trying to push the same amount of air you've been pushing into a reduced air space in the lungs. Also, these patients are going to be experiencing rapid respirations, although as they progress and become more fatigued, they may be slowing down, and that is an ominous sign. So if you start having slowed respirations, these patients need respiratory support. You need to go ahead and start bagging them immediately. Assist their respirations with that bag valve mask. You're also going to be looking for things like jugular venous distension. The increased pressure in the chest cavity causes, again, that cardiac side effect, that fluid backup as the venous return is impeded by the increased pressure in the chest cavity. So you may have JVD show up. You're also going to have tracheal deviation, and the tracheal deviation will be to the contralateral side. Think about it. It's pushing the lungs away from where the bubble is, and so it's going to cause that airway to shift to the side away from the injury or away from the pneumothorax. And you just think about having that airway hinged at the top and acting like a pendulum in the chest cavity. If something is pushing on one side, it's going to shift away from that area. So if you see tracheal deviation, that is an ominous sign as well. And JVD and tracheal deviation are considered late signs of pneumothorax. That's where the pneumothorax has really progressed to the point that it's really pushing on the opposite side and also impeding on the mediastinum area and impeding the cardiac function as well. You can have displacement of the cardiac sounds. So if you've been listening to the patient and you hear a strong apical heartbeat, and a little bit later that strong heartbeat sound is moved an inch to the one side, again, the contralateral side, that would be an indication that the heart is being pushed away from the pneumothorax. So these are all some of the findings you're going to be looking at. Again, anything to do with respirations, you're looking for altered mental status, you're looking for other issues with these patients, and you certainly want to treat them aggressively. So what is the treatment here? Well, first of all, in your initial assessment, if you find a patient with a penetrating chest injury that you hear air movement in, that is called a sucking chest wound, and that is something you're going to slap a gloved hand on top of immediately, using that as an occlusive dressing to close off further air entry into that site, okay? And in fact, you may be able to cause that site to become a passage for moving air out of the injury area as you would with a needle decompression. But initially, you want to occlude that site, and a gloved hand is the best thing you have available immediately. Now, there are many occlusive dressings that are out there on the marketplace, but I know a lot of services out there carry just normal old Saran wrap. It is wrapped up and food grade, so it is sterile, and you just unwrap enough of it to get to a point that it's clean and then slap that over the injured site. You can also use the inside of just about any medical packaging material. You can use something like the container that your IV fluid comes wrapped in. You can use the wrapper from a container of 4x4s is airtight and watertight, and you can use that to cover the wound as well. These are all things that you need to do to get this occluded and keep additional air from entering, so that maybe you don't have a tension pneumothorax yet, but just a pneumothorax, and you can stop that from occurring. Once you've identified the immediate life threat, if the patient does indeed have signs of a tension pneumothorax, absent breath sounds on one side, tracheal deviation, jugular venous distension, severe respiratory distress, this patient would be a candidate for chest decompression, needle decompression of the chest. In my protocols in Maryland, we only have one site on each side to access. That is the midclavicular line in the center, in the second intercostal space. You'll need to follow your own protocols for that, but there are good needle decompression kits out there available. You will use the large gauge needle, and we're talking about 14 gauge needles that you're going to access. You're going to clean the site. You're going to rapidly locate your landmarks. You're going to slide up over the top of the ribs. Again, you want to go over the ribs rather than under the ribs because of the association with nerve and vessels just under each of the ribs. So by sliding up and over the rib, you avoid impacting any of those systems. You're going to access, you're going to listen for the escape of gas, you're going to apply your one-way valve, And there are a lot of different products out there that come with their own one-way valve associated with them. If you don't have one, you've always seen using the large gauge IV catheter and then using the tip of a glove with a slit cut in it, and that acts as a one-way valve. As it flaps down, it can let air escape and then flap back down again to close off the end of the needle, and you can tape that on there in place. You're going to stabilize your needle catheter in place like you would any impaled object so that it can be stabilized in place and not induce additional trauma to these patients, and you'll go ahead and monitor them periodically. You also want to reassess after the fact. Is there a return in breath sounds on that side gradually as that lung begins to reinflate? These are things you're going to want to watch for as you monitor these patients. Now, in some jurisdictions, there will be a mid-axillary point on the rib cage where you can access and needle decompress farther down on the chest, but this is not something I'm very familiar with, and I'm going to let you refer to your own protocols to do that, but there are additional sites that may be allowed under your protocols. Again, if you're sitting a patient up in a semi-Fowler's or high Fowler's position, you hope that that bubble will rise in the chest cavity to the point that accessing that pneumothorax high in the chest is going to allow you to bleed off enough air to allow return of some function on that side. So we'll want to monitor that. Also, in patients with severe chest trauma or cardiac arrest related to trauma, it may be indicated for you to try a bilateral needle decompression. Perhaps patients with a crushing chest blow have had bilateral pneumothorax develop, and you can help restore function and perhaps avoid a fatal trauma arrest in these patients by, first of all, checking to see if they have a pneumothorax going on, which is impeding blood flow and, of course, impeding oxygenation. In either case, once you've finished your treatment of life-threatening injuries, and that is covering up any open chest wounds and administering needle decompression as necessary in life-threatening situations, patients with a pneumothorax that is not developed to the point of being a tension pneumothorax need to be monitored like any respiratory distress patient. They need to be carefully assessed. You need to mark and note in your resources and documentation exactly how the lung sounds are doing. You're going to listen to those lung sounds. You're going to want to look for your landmarks when you're assessing lung sounds, because you need to be able to note changes in the presence of lung sounds. And you need to note if that's getting better or worse, because you may be able to note the progression to a tension pneumothorax and be able to deal with it appropriately. In any case, these patients are going to get oxygen. Most cases, I would think high flow O2 to alleviate some of their respiratory distress, and you're going to want to transport them to an appropriate facility. These patients are going to need a chest tube. They're going to need the air evacuated, and they're going to need a facility that can handle that. Most likely, this is going to be a trauma center, although some local facilities may want you to transport the patient to them, and they will determine whether they need to go to a more advanced surgical facility. Again, if this is a medically related, simple, spontaneous pneumothorax, it may be more indicated for you to go to a local facility, but in any case, this is a traumatic injury. Remember, even though it's medically related, these patients have a traumatic problem in their chest cavity and are going to require surgery to at least help replace it by way of a chest tube, if not invasive surgery to repair the injury directly. Hopefully, the administration of a chest tube and a good drainage system in the hospital setting will allow these patients to heal on their own in some cases, but these patients definitely need to go to an appropriate facility. So consultation with medical control is really important in cases of these patients. Does your local facility want this patient when you suspect a pneumothorax, or do they want you to contact trauma and head into a different facility? So that's a broad overview of pneumothorax, tension pneumothorax, as well as simple spontaneous pneumothorax, and some of the treatment modalities and presentations that you might expect to see in the field. I hope that helps you out, and remember to check the links in the show notes for this particular episode. And I think that's going to wrap up another episode here of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out this week's show. And again, urge you to remember to go and check your own protocols for any of the things that I talk about on the show. I can cover the high points and I can talk about my experiences, but it is really your job to make sure that you're checking in with your own medical director, your own training officer, your own instructors, and following up in the appropriate way for your regional protocols and the guidelines under which you operate. So I just want to make sure everybody knows that. The information is really here for general knowledge purposes and refresher purposes, and I hope that it accomplishes that, but certainly you want to follow up on your own. If you have any comments or suggestions for future episodes, tips, tricks, or meds, you can always send that information in to me here by sending me an email here at podmedic@mac.com. I love to hear from the listeners. You know that because I always talk about listener mail at the top of the show, but I always want to make sure you all know that just because you hear from somebody else with a similar story doesn't mean that I don't want to hear what you have to say as well. Don't forget to do what Jeff did and call into the voicemail line as well. I love to hear from everybody, and I'd also like to put out a special call. If you have recently tested or tested in the past while you've listened to the show, I'm looking for some testimonials, some people that thought that the MedicCast really helped you out and helped you pass your EMT or your paramedic program because of the information I provided here. So if that's the case for you and you'd like to call in and share that via the voicemail line, I'm looking for some things that I can throw up on the MedicCast Extra site and let people that show up there know what they can expect and what other people have found from the information provided by the MedicCast. So always you can help out in that way. Call in to the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. All right, it's time to close out the show, as I always do, with some good old PodSafe music for you. This is a song from our good friend Matthew Ebel. Matthew is a great singer-songwriter and makes his songs available over at the PodSafe Music Network, as well as at the iTunes store. So make sure you check out the links in the show notes to go over and purchase Jeff's music, or check out his website. He actually has a setup right now, if you head over to his website at MatthewEbel.com, that you can actually get 3 free MP3 downloads from his site just for signing up for his artist newsletter. So that's a great deal as far as I'm concerned. And if you like Matt's music as much as I have, you're going to go ahead and purchase the CDs anyway. So this is Matt's song, Downtown. I've played it before here on the show. It's one of his latest tracks and is one of my favorites of his. Okay, I guess that's it. I will close out the show and say that I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I want to remind all of you folks to remember Scene Safety, BSI. Stars with some pumps and a bag full of clothes.
shots look a mess, but baby, you better sell, or your daddy gonna raise hell. He gives you money, but honey, your daddy don't.